But there's still a long way to go. I suggest we work for a moment on your next set of objectives. Is that all right? I agreed. An hour later, we read out together the steadily lengthening list. Continue to adopt positive techniques to increase a state of zen and harmony. Continue to work on relationship with Sebastian. Set boundaries with Adrienne, but work toward easing tension between us. Clarify the new project for work. Study its feasibility and the ways to make it happen. Start carrying it out. I couldn't help giving a deep sigh to think that only a few moments earlier I had been jumping for joy. Claude saw how discouraged I was and said, "Don't give up, Camille. Remember the saying, Rome wasn't built in a day. Keep focused on each task, every mission." "Thanks, Claude. Really, thank you for everything you're doing for me." He shook my hand warmly, visibly pleased at my progress. How many people would work so hard to help someone like this with no guarantee of being paid? Frankly, I thought he was crazy, but I had to admire him for it. 20. I went on doggedly applying Claude's advice day after day. By now, I knew by heart what I needed to do to get myself into the virtuous circle column. But as he often said, the important thing was not to know, but to do. He was always praising the benefits of regularity and tenacity. By the end of the fourth month, I had the impression that I had crossed a critical threshold. I was beginning to really appreciate my new way of living, eating, moving, thinking. I was on the brink of reaching the famous mind-body reconciliation the Asian teachings so insist on. The few minutes I spent every day on exercises and stretching had put me back in touch with my body, a body that somehow I had not really been living in until now. I ended up enjoying the exercises and even looked forward to how they made me feel. When I walked in the street, I tried occasionally to imagine my body as a hyphen linking sky and earth, to feel myself as part of a great totality rather than as an isolated entity lost in nature. I became aware of just how cut off I had been from my feelings. But from now on, I was determined to live in the present. Gone were the days wasted in going over and over the past or in torturing myself about the future. It was so relaxing. I also began to realize the role that nature and fresh air could play in my physical and mental well-being. Having grown up surrounded by concrete and pollution, I had convinced myself I didn't like nature. But I'd had entirely the wrong impression of it, imagining millions of tiny crawling or flying creatures lying in wait in vast, silent green landscapes that promise the epitome of boredom. Getting in touch with nature again brought me unexpected comfort. I would never have thought I could absorb so much energy from its marvels. One day, Claude decided to introduce me to Ikebana, the Japanese floral art that aims to relax and calm the spirit by creating a silent dialogue with nature. We set out for a walk in the country, armed with clippers to gather plants. Then, under his watchful eye, I had fun creating a floral poem that combined a subtle balance of shapes and colors. Whereas before, I never had time to be still, now I spent several minutes each day in front of the Zen hearth that I had built. Inspired by the Japanese tokonoma, it was an alcove decorated with a kakemono scroll painting, an ikebana floral composition, and several symbolic objects, a candelabra, a statue, a work of art. I had found the perfect spot for it, a small, previously unused corner at the far end of the living room. I placed a long, plain vase on the floor to put my ikebana creations in. On the wall, I hung three different sized cubes. Each of them contained items to inspire and motivate me. The first had a laughing Buddha, and next to it, a pretty postcard with the inscription, "To do what you love is freedom. To love what you do is happiness. The second had a beautiful candle and my three favorite books of the moment. In the third were a family photo of the three of us and a small statue of the venerated Hindu god Shiva, often presented as the auspicious one. A few soft, brightly colored cushions on the floor encouraged a contemplative break from routine. Whenever I felt stressed out, I treated myself to a few moments of peace in this corner, staring at the candle flame until I was almost hypnotized by it. This change in my philosophy of life sustained me from within. As the weeks went by, I felt a great deal less anxious, less agitated. I also became aware that in the past I had tended to focus on my disappointments. No wonder I was chronically out of sorts. Claude had suggested an antidote to this negativity, to find room every day for a few moments of gratitude. And so I got up each morning with a thank you in my head and went to bed each night with the same thought. Thanks for having a healthy son, having a roof over my head, of living in a country at peace. Thanks for having a companion alongside me to love and support me. I even got into the habit of giving thanks for less important things, a steaming hot cup of coffee in the early morning, an apple tart shared with my family. I also took to heart the idea of taking care every day of the people and things around me, taking care of a plant, an animal, of yourself, of your loved ones, but also of everyone you met on your way who might need it. You only live in so far as you give, Claude had quite rightly said to me once. He had also sent me a book of the Dalai Lama's thoughts to nurture my new mindset. He had taken care to underline some passages with a marker. A few phrases in particular stayed with me, such as, by encouraging altruism, love, tenderness, and compassion, one discourages hatred, desire, or pride. Such ideas had always resonated with me, but in recent years, out of laziness or carelessness, I had let them slip. The secret was never to stop acting on them, to think of them every day. If you don't, you quickly resume the default position of making no effort, and bad habits along with it. I also liked this quote. Some people see the mud at the bottom of the pond. Others gaze at the lotus flower floating on the surface. The choice is yours. This seemed to me a good illustration of the different ways people view life. Little by little, I became aware of what makes for happiness, becoming involved in a loving relationship, a family, work. It didn't really matter what. As for what gives life meaning, it now seemed to me that it involved getting to know how to give the best of yourself based on the qualities that made up your true identity. Be good at what you do, and be good to others. Wasn't that the key? Some might object that they are not good at anything, that in fact they are bad at everything. By now I was convinced that such people simply have too many toxins in their mindset. The good news is that it is perfectly possible to detoxify your mind and reveal your potential for development. Everyone has good qualities. The trick is to identify them, then help them flourish. This will give you the essence of what is best in you. All this was going through my mind when I received a message from Claude that echoed my own thoughts.
Good morning, Camille. Your tasks for the coming 3 weeks: positive thinking, auto-suggestion, and meditation. You need to practice these every day if you're going to reprogram your mindset. You're going to be busy, but it's all in a good cause, isn't it?
I sent him a text in return. Why 3 weeks? He replied immediately.
That's the shortest length of time it takes for change to take root and become a habit.
Together with this, he had sent me a small package. I rushed to open it. Within some bubble wrap was a kind of glass jam jar. It looked nice, but for some reason made me wary. Inside it, Claude had inserted a scroll of paper.
I unscrewed the top and took out the message. It ran for 2 long pages. Camille, here is your swear jar. It'll be a kind of store to prevent wallowing and negative thoughts. You are to put €1 in the jar each time you have a pessimistic idea or say anything unconstructive. I can only hope you don't end up with a fortune in there. I can't repeat this enough. Positive thoughts have a real impact on your body and your psyche. Some very serious studies prove it. Here's one example. An experiment carried out under scientific conditions. They filled 2 containers about the size of a dessert plate with the same amount of earth. Then they planted 23 grass seeds in each of them with the same amount of compost. They put them in a greenhouse next to each other to make sure they would receive exactly the same amount of sunshine each day and enjoy the same temperatures while the seeds were germinating. The only difference was as follows. 3 times a day, each of the researchers took turns to sit in front of both containers. In front of the first, they said very negative things, attacking the seeds verbally. Nothing will ever grow here. Nothing is going to happen. This will never produce grass. I really don't think the soil is fertile. And even if it does grow, I'm sure it's going to wither and die. In front of the second pot, they behaved completely differently. They were confident and said nice things. They were very positive about the seeds germinating and the possibility of seeing grass grow. I can hardly wait to see these seeds sprout. It's going to be great. The weather is fine. The temperature is perfect. That's going to help as well. I've got green fingers. Everything I plant is a success. 3 weeks later, a photo of the 2 pots appeared in Time magazine. I hardly need to tell you that from the first pot, which had been exposed to the negative comments, only 2 or 3 feeble shoots had sprouted. The second, on the other hand, was covered in a dark green grass, deeply rooted in the soil and already robust and tall. I'm sure you've understood my point, Camille. Our words give off vibes, our attitude as well. If they have such an amazing influence on seeds, just imagine the effect they can produce on people. That's why we have to pay as much attention to our inner dialogue as to our comments to others. Why not make a start today? Hoping to see you soon, Claude. I was impressed by the example he had given me and more than ready to try to change. But I sensed how difficult it would be for me, as I had for so long been in the habit of expressing the negative rather than the positive. Claude had warned me, just as the athlete has to train every day, so reprogramming one's thoughts demands tenacity, an effort. Not to mention being vigilant all the time, because it's so easy for the mind to slip back into the bad old habits if you're not careful. I promised myself I would be extra vigilant and put the jar on the bookshelves in the living room where I could see it easily. I even decided to see if the men of the family would play the game as well. Adrienne really liked the idea. The next morning, Sebastian emerged from the bedroom, clearly grumpy after a night without much sleep. He went over to the window.
God, look at this weather. It's so depressing.
I didn't even need to say anything.
Adrienne did it for me. Dad, €1, he cried, delighted to have caught his father out.
Sebastian started to protest, but quickly stopped when he realized that the more he grumbled, the more money he would have to put in the jar.
No, no, no. Okay, I won't do it anymore. I don't want to end up completely broke.
And he went over to give his guardian of the positive a big hug. As for me, I tried every day to practice positive thoughts and attitude, to alter the way I put things, to make them not negative but positive, to make them not passive but active, a real mental somersault. I had printed out a short fable that Claude had sent me and that I often reread.
It's the story of a man who goes looking for a wise man to learn from him.
Tell me, you who are so wise, what is in your mind?
In my mind, there are two dogs, one black and one white. The black dog is full of hate, anger, and pessimism. The white one is filled with love, generosity, and optimism. They fight all the time. His disciple is rather taken aback.
Two dogs? Who fight each other?
Yes, almost all the time.
And which one wins?
The one I feed more.
It was clear that for years my thoughts must have been much more like a large Doberman pincher than a pretty little Maltese puppy. Well, I just have to adjust the canine register of my mind, in a manner of speaking. Claude added another principle to my already long list, one that came from the Emperor Augustus's favorite adage, festina lente, or make haste slowly. It seems that like many other people, I habitually confused speed and haste. In recent years, I had spent my time doing everything quickly and badly, living like a fly caught in a jar, buzzing around, beating my head against the glass walls of life, and not allowing myself the time to sit back and take stock. So I urged myself to live life more slowly, to refuse to accept the tyranny of the fast lane, to act, of course, but not to give in to useless pressure, to understand the huge difference between good and bad stress. I was putting this into practice at work when I received a fresh message from Claude. He was suggesting yet another mystery rendezvous the following Wednesday at an address in Charenton-le-Pont. All he said was that I should bring a swimsuit and a towel. A swimsuit? But there was absolutely no way I wanted to go swimming. 21. That Wednesday, I arrived at our meeting place feeling a bit grumpy. Although, to be fair, I had put a euro in the swear jar. Unlike me, Claude seemed on top of the world and excited. What surprise did he have in store for me this time? It didn't take long to find out. He had brought me not to any ordinary swimming pool, but to one that specialized in scuba diving. When I realized this, my heart started pounding. I was trapped. Surely he didn't want me to. Yes, he did. I tried to protest, to get out of it, claiming that I had never learned to hold my breath, that I wasn't sure I could do it for even 10 seconds. Claude waved away my fears and told me the point of the exercise. He wanted me to understand the importance of my breathing in channeling my emotions and to stay in control of myself in any given situation. Okay, I got the general idea, but did I really have to prove it by trying this extreme sport? As if by magic, an instructor appeared with all the equipment, and quicker than I could say, stop, I found myself strapped into a load of very heavy gear that I didn't have the faintest idea how to use. My brain almost ceased to function. I found it hard to follow and retain the instructor's directions, especially when it came to the signals for communicating underwater. If Claude thought I was going to play at being a mermaid, he had another think coming. Rather than graceful and agile in the water, I looked more like a hippo brought up in the Sahara, with the regulator stretching my mouth and my hair spreading all round me like tentacles. I looked more like Medusa, with her snakes, than the sweet little mermaid Ariel. Be that as it may, the sight of me underwater gave Claude a good laugh. I tried to give him a little kick, but the water slowed all my movements. He must have seen the frown spreading across my face, but he did not relent, apart from asking with a signal if I felt all right. I shrugged to show that I didn't, but the instructor soon led me down to the bottom of the pool, and I became completely absorbed in the experience. At first, my anxiety made my heart race. I had to force myself to breathe in a controlled fashion to calm myself and avoid hyperventilating. All at once, I understood. I could sense that breathing was the key to managing my movements. After a few unsuccessful attempts, I began to judge things better,
I even found myself able to float up or down just by controlling my breathing. The sense of weightlessness was exhilarating. By varying the amount of air in your lungs, you could control how high you rose, becoming heavier or lighter as you wished. That meant I could adjust my position underwater with minimal effort. By the end of the session, I felt completely at ease and even dared turn a few somersaults by pushing off from the side of the pool. Had I overdone the oxygen? I felt lightheaded.
"So, how was it?" Claude asked me outside the changing rooms.
"Wonderful. But you could have warned me." I poked him in the ribs to wipe the sly grin off his face.
"Ow," he said, laughing. "It would have been a shame to miss it. You looked so charming. A mermaid in a swimming pool."
I pulled a face.
"If I told you what I was up to, would you have come? You wouldn't, would you?"
He was right there. I left the swimming pool feeling much prouder than when I had gone in. It was a unique experience that would be added to my list of powerful memories and anchors in my positive notebook. While we were waiting for the bus to take us back to Paris, Claude insisted on making another point.
"We should spend a couple of minutes reflecting on the lesson to be drawn from this experience. Whenever you find yourself under stress, concentrate on your breathing and remember what it felt like to be diving underwater. How calm it is below the surface, peaceful, the way you managed your breathing, your self-control. You need to become aware of your breathing even on a normal day. Bear in mind that healthy breathing is not merely breathing in, but also the way you breathe out. If you expel all the air in your lungs, that gives them the chance to refill with new air, which will help your body more."
"You're right. It's something you need to know."
"And now, you do."
22. With all that I was learning from Claude, I tried hard each day to live more aware of myself, even when I was doing the most mundane things. Brushing my teeth or chewing my food became new and interesting experiences and increased my sensory awareness. I understood the saying, "To live in a dream world," much better now. It was true that you could go through life disconnected from yourself, with the annoying consequence that you were never in the only place that really matters, the here and now. The previous evening, Claude had sent me a text message with a formula I really liked. "Today is a gift. That's why it's called the present." But the more aware I became, the harder it was to see my family continuing to live in what I now saw as the wrong way. So that evening, at dinner, I exploded.
"No, Sebastian, get off your laptop, we're eating. That's the flipping limit. We don't see much of you as it is. And if when we do, you're not really here."
"But I am here. I'm sorry, but I'm expecting an urgent email. It's work, so don't get mad up about it."
"In other words, you're not paying any attention to what you're eating."
"Who puts these ideas in your head? That guru of yours?"
"Breathe calmly. Don't play the game. Don't get angry. Think kind thoughts."
"Exactly. I'm working on how to become completely aware. And it's life-changing."
"I'd like to see it," he said sarcastically.
"Okay, I'll take you at your word. In fact, I was about to propose we do something interesting together in the near future."
"You were? What?"
"You'll see." I said nothing more. I wanted it to come as a complete surprise. I was following Claude's method of directly experiencing something that would teach a real lesson. I had found a very special place in Paris that would help me make Sebastian realize in a concrete, empirical way what it meant to be fully aware and its benefits. I was very pleased with myself and was rejoicing in advance at how my surprise would affect him, imagining the amused, sexy look on his face. However, when the day came and he discovered where I had taken him, he seemed worried rather than pleased.
"So this was your big idea?" he muttered so dubiously that I had a sudden moment of panic.
What if this evening, which was meant to be a celebration for just the two of us, turned into a fiasco before it had even begun? I wasn't having that, so I tried to cheer him up. Come on, Seb, trust me. It'll be great, you'll see. It'll be a laugh. It didn't work. While we were waiting for our allotted attendant, I could see him casting a skeptical glance at the entrance where we were standing, trying to see through the heavy curtains hiding the room where our festivities were to take place. The curtains looked like those heavy rubber ones at the start of ghost train rides at amusement parks. Our host, Vincent, finally arrived. He instructed me to stand behind Sebastian and place my hands on his shoulders. Then he took Seb's hands and placed them on his shoulders, inviting us to follow him through the curtains. We entered a room that was in total darkness. And when I say total, that's still not strong enough. I chuckled, feeling Sebastian's back trembling under my hands. He wasn't exactly enjoying it. We groped our way until we found our chair backs and sat down for this blind man's lunch. I have to admit that at the start I didn't feel very comfortable either. Enveloped in this complete darkness, the only way we could get our bearings was to judge how far away the sounds were that we could hear around us. And that made me quite anxious. Was I going to be able to survive 2 hours like this, with no visual input at all, clinging to the table like a life raft in the darkness? We began to fill the dark space with disjointed conversation, both of us equally lost in this unusual situation, clumsily attempting to learn this new sensory alphabet. And yet, to judge by the lively talk and laughter from the other guests around us, it seemed we would soon get over our awkwardness. Fortunately, the arrival of the first course helped us relax. Vincent, a non-sighted person, took great care of us and served us a surprising dish. In this unaccustomed universe, we tasted it as much with our fingers as with our palates. We also rediscovered our mouth's ability to distinguish different flavors. It was as though we each had 1,001 taste buds. The fact that we were deprived of sight seemed to enhance our other faculties, and the result was an explosion of sensation. Well, now do you see what it's like to eat while being fully aware of what you're tasting?
1 point to you.
Admit that this is a nice surprise, isn't it?
I admit it. Good plan.
Our voices and words acquired a new resonance. Not being able to see each other's face and expressions, the rhythms of our breathing and intonation became much more important. The meal continued with one taste adventure following another, punctuated by different wines, all of them subtle delights that detonated in our mouths as our senses continued to reveal their hidden talents. Ordinarily, we only use less than 10% of their potential, just like our brains. By the end of the meal, I could sense that Sebastian had been won over. He talked enthusiastically about his feelings, tried to define as accurately as possible the nuances of the dishes and wines we were offered, and to guess which herbs or spices had seasoned the sauces. This new awareness affected him even more than I had expected. Awakening his senses seemed to give him a taste for more.
Thank you, darling. This has been a wonderful initiation. But aren't you afraid that all this might give me ideas about other equally interesting ways we can become fully aware of what we're sharing? He said warmly, grabbing hold of my bread roll rather than my hand, and then knocking over my wine when he finally made contact.
I laughed. I knew perfectly well what he was talking about, and personally, I had absolutely no objection. 23. I was pleased with my progress and sensed I was on the right track. Yet, that did not stop me from feeling painfully on edge at times. I was in a strange, euphoric state that disrupted my sleep and undermined my calm. In other words, I was stressed out. I wasn't going to become a Zen master anytime soon. The changes in my life, so many and so rapid, had set my mind reeling. My nerves were overloaded, and it wouldn't be long before I blew a fuse. I desperately needed to relieve the pressure. I couldn't carry on like this, and so I spoke to Claude about it. He He saw this as an excellent opportunity to make me conscious of the benefits of meditation and heart rate control, concepts that were utterly alien to an energizer bunny like me. There's nothing I like less than sitting still. It makes me feel useless, as if I'm wasting time. I really think that meditation is a no-no for me.
That's what you say now, Camille, but it's like all the rest. You'll get there. Only a few weeks ago, the idea of doing 10 minutes exercise a day seemed impossible to you. So did eating, in a different way.
Yes, but this isn't the same. It's not in my nature to be zen.
No one is asking you to change your nature. Just to alter a few details in your daily life to achieve greater well-being and calm.
I don't deny it must be great for those who can do it, but I just can't stay still. I've always been that way.
Always, never. What if you forget about those absolutes? Don't you even want to try?
I agreed, slightly ashamed of protesting so much.
Don't worry, Camille. You can do it. It's simply a question of adapting. Afterward, you won't be able to do without it. Did you know that according to some very serious studies, monks and other experts have better health and a stronger immune system? It's worth giving it a shot, isn't it?
Definitely. But at the moment, it just seems very hard to organize.
Just one question. Do you enjoy being so stressed, so tense all the time?
No, of course not.
But it must do something for you if you're so determined to hang on to a way of life that leaves no room at all for calm and introspection.
I could see he was going to leave me without a leg to stand on. Okay, fine, I said, giving in. I promise to try.
I'm sure you can do it, he said with a broad smile. You'll see, there's no great magic to it. All you have to do is train yourself to find a little calm and silence, and to learn to look at what's happening inside you. Make a start, 2 or 3 times a day, with a session of deep breathing. 6 breaths a minute for 5 minutes. That's the rhythm that slows down your system. You can do it anywhere, even in the metro.
I'll believe you.
Another very interesting exercise is the one I call the harmonizer. It combines the principles of controlling your heart rate with positive visualization.
Isn't that getting a bit complicated?
Not at all. The basic principle is the same. At some point in your day, you need to create a bubble of tranquility by shutting yourself in a room where you won't be disturbed. Sit down comfortably with your back straight and try to breathe calmly. Then place your hand on your heart and breathe, while at the same time visualizing your heart swelling up each time you inhale and returning to normal size whenever you exhale. Once you are perfectly calm, add a positive visualization, a memory that warms your heart. Then try to relive those emotions and sensations as intensely as possible. Simple, isn't it?
What if no image comes to me?
I admit that at first it might seem rather difficult, but you should build up an inner catalog of positive images and memories. A mental photo album. The more you work at it, the more complete it will become, and you'll be able to access it easily.
Yes, that's not a bad idea.
But I think that at this point, what would be most useful would be for you to meet a real master in the art.
I beg your pardon?
Master Wu. I'll take you to him. After your visit, everything will be much clearer. You'll see.
We drove for 3/4 of an hour before we reached Master Wu's home. I could hardly wait to meet him. While we sped past a landscape of open fields, I discreetly began to control my breathing and try some positive visualization.
Got you, Camille, Claude suddenly shouted.
What?
Again, that sly little smile of his. I've been watching you out of the corner of my eye for a few minutes now, and I can see you've started the training already.
So?
So nothing. That's great. Carry on. Don't worry about me.
We finally arrived at our destination. The tires crunched on the gravel of the drive up to the house. Several dogs came out to greet us, muzzles flecked with foam, barking gruffly. The owner of the house called them to heal, and the dogs obeyed her instantly. Doubtless, she could have made them take a bite out of our ankles or lick our hands simply by raising her voice or clicking her tongue. I was impressed by her natural self-assurance. Claudia told her we were coming, and her smile was like a pair of open arms.
Good afternoon, Claude. How are you?
Very well, Jacqueline. How about you? It's really good of you to see us. May I introduce Camille? I've talked to you about her.
Jacqueline was a matronly woman, generously built, with a baby face that made her look cheerful. Frankly, this was not what I had been expecting. I was imagining someone more Asian.
I'm so pleased to meet you, Camille. So, you'd like to meet Master Wu?
She asked, a glint in her eye.
Yes, I would.
I understand. Lots of people would like to get to know him. Follow me.
We went through a spacious living room with an ancient hearth and exposed beams. The gentle winter sun filtered in through wide bay windows.
What a lovely room.
Thank you, said our hostess, apparently delighted at my compliment.
Now, Master Wu is in the courtyard.
I'll let you go and find him. I'll be in the kitchen. See you soon.
Claude allowed me to go out first. I was already smiling a warm welcome as my eyes scanned the courtyard. My smile gradually faded. I couldn't see anyone. I was terribly disappointed. Had Master Wu already left? Seeing how crestfallen I was, Claude insisted,
"He's over there."
I still couldn't see anyone.
"There, Camille," he said, pointing.
I followed the direction of his finger. Comfortably installed on an embroidered cushion, a magnificent Persian cat was stretched out, dozing peacefully. He transmitted a combination of majesty and utter peacefulness. I stopped short, in shock. Then, pulling myself together, I turned toward the practical joker. We drove for 3/4 of an hour. For this?
What on earth are you playing at? I snapped.
Claude's face showed a mixture of satisfaction and contrition.
Forgive my little game, Camille, but I couldn't think of a better example than Master Wu to show you what complete relaxation can be. If you think you won't be able to meditate, start by learning to be a cat for a few minutes each day. There's no one like him for being peaceful and calm, completely anchored in the here and now.
I shot him a furious look, which led him to seek refuge in the kitchen, alongside Jacqueline. Left on my own with Master Wu, I watched him simply being for a few moments and was surprised to feel a pleasant sensation of peace slowly invade me. As his tail moved to and fro, he seemed to be composing an invisible treatise on the virtues of slowness. His very own hymn to Carpe Diem. He didn't even move when I plunged my hand into his warm fur to stroke him. I realized then that I really shouldn't be angry with Claude for having brought me here. Feeling much more relaxed, I rejoined him and Jacqueline in the kitchen. They were chatting away, enjoying a cup of fresh mint tea, picked from the garden, as my hostess pointed out. I could tell that Claude was searching my face to see how I was going to react. When he spotted my unspoken thanks, he seemed happy. The afternoon ended on a note of culinary delight. A plum tart that more than made up for the long journey. 24. From the day I met Master Wu, I enjoyed playing at being a cat as often as possible, to the great pleasure of my nerve ends. Strangely, the more serene I became, the more I felt my vital energy being replenished. And together with that, I must admit, an increasing libido. In all honesty, I was rather thrown by this. Embarrassed by these renewed impulses, at first I tried to ignore them. I didn't dare mention them to Claude, in case he thought I was going a bit too far. In the end, however, I couldn't bear it any more and forced myself to talk about it. I don't know how to say this, but, well, for a few days now, I've been feeling a kind of renewal of my libido, and I don't know what to make of it. I'd like to know if it has anything to do with our program of change. Plainly taken aback by my question, Claude cleared his throat, but then answered anyway.
It doesn't really surprise me, Camille. Yes, of course, it goes hand in hand with the changes you're going through. The fact of becoming proactive, of taking your life back into your own hands, of working on your body and your mind. All that helps generate positive energy, which means that you want to live your life as a woman to the full. And that's good news, isn't it?
Yes, but I don't know why. It makes me uneasy. That's why I wanted to talk to you about it.
I understand. Perhaps what's upsetting you is discovering a part of yourself that you haven't really explored as yet. Another Camille, as it were. A bolder woman, more in touch with her desires and sensuality.
I blushed. The thing is, I'm still not entirely sure I like the image that could reflect of me.
That's only normal. Even today, what we have been taught for thousands of years still influences us deeply. For all those years, our sexuality has been constrained by morality and taboos. Such a heritage is bound to leave its mark, and women are only just beginning to enjoy sexual freedom and acknowledge they have desires that are as strong as those men have. Now we just need everyone to accept this new sexual norm.
You're right. What I'd like to do is to bring some of this new energy into my relationship. To be the one who suggests things, comes up with new ideas, if you see what I mean. Do you think I should take the initiative?
Claude smiled at me, his eyes twinkling. Of course. Your husband will be delighted. I wasn't so certain.
Nevertheless, I did take the initiative. Throughout the whole of the following week, I plotted my first surprise. Adrienne was left with my mother for the evening. The ever-fashionable little black dress with a décolletage low enough to make even a long-standing partner take notice. The 4-inch heels that I kept for special occasions. Champagne ready to serve in chilled glasses to welcome my nearest and dearest. A last quick look in the mirror. No doubt about it, I was hot. It had been a long time since I saw myself in such good shape, with sparkling eyes and glowing skin. Sebastian was going to go weak at the knees. Surely. When he arrived home, it took him several seconds to get used to the semi-darkness before he got a good look at me. Then I gave him my most alluring smile, which brought him up short. I secretly rejoiced at this moment when I could see from his expression that I had achieved my effect. Surprise, bewilderment, interest. At last. I decided to go for broke in staging this seduction scene. I played it for all it was worth, a cinematic kiss beneath the spotlights in our living room. My arms slid round his shoulders. Hello, big man, I said. I was really enjoying seeing how excited, almost intimidated he was.
Wow, what a welcome, he murmured. You're magnificent.
I was bubbling over inside. And you haven't seen anything yet, I said, playing my femme fatale role to the hilt. Our eyelids closed. We kissed again as if in close-up, gently, passionately. I pressed my mouth against his, utterly caught up in my own fantasy. My body arched against him, one hand low on his back, the other slipping inside his shirt. I was already imagining the rest of the film projected onto the screen of a night without sleep. I was sliding my hand down his thigh when all of a sudden, Sebastian pulled away.
What?
Are you all right, sweetheart? Is something wrong? I murmured, my voice thick with the promise of pleasure.
No, nothing. It's just that...
At that precise moment, my mobile rang. I cursed modern technology. But what could I do? It was my mother. I had forgotten to put Adrienne's antihistamine in his bag. I felt a stab of guilt, but tried to reassure her. It was no big deal for just one night. Yes, he could do without it. No, there was no need to go and find a late-night pharmacy. While I was half listening to her, I was casting sideways glances at Sebastian to try to assess his mood.
Oh-ho, my mother clucked. From your voice, I can tell I'm disturbing you. So, the evening's gotten off to a good start, has it?
I hated the thought that she was busy trying to imagine what was going on in our apartment.
Mum, I protested.
But then I relented. After all, it was thanks to her that I was able to enjoy this quiet evening with my husband. Well, I was hoping it wouldn't be too quiet. So I thanked her profusely before ending the call. Sebastian had gotten up and was standing by the window with his back to me. I sneaked up on him, took him in my arms, and whispered in his ear, "Hey, what's wrong?" In order not to have to reply, he rained little kisses on my neck, cheeks, and mouth. "Sebastian, that's enough," I said softly. "Tell me." He was avoiding meeting my eyes. I gently took his head in my hands and forced him to look at me.
"I'm sorry, Cam," he said eventually. "I know it's absurd. I don't know what's come over me. There you are, looking stunning, sexy, taking the lead. And all of a sudden, it makes me..."
"It makes you what?"
"I don't know. It makes me nervous."
I let go of him and took a step back. "I get it. You don't love me, is that it?"
He didn't say a word.
That hurt, and it made me angry, as disappointed as I was upset. I grabbed the empty champagne glasses to take them back to the kitchen, clacking my heels on the parquet in protest. I made as much noise as possible while I put everything away. Sebastian had followed me silently and stood behind me. He was as immobile as I was hyperactive, crashing about all over the place. I could sense him gazing at me, a sad, confused expression on his face. After a while, I couldn't bear it any longer and confronted him. "What is it? Tell me. Go on. What's wrong?" I could see from the way his lips were moving wordlessly that he was unsure how to get it off his chest. Then all of a sudden, he exploded.
"I'm stupid, so stupid. I'm sorry. You've changed so much recently. You're so much more... Whereas I...
Now he was the one pacing up and down the room, waving his arms around wildly to try to express himself clearly. He looked so awkward that I felt myself softening. I went up to him and took his head in my hands.
"What about you?" I said gently. I think I'm afraid.
Afraid?
Yes, afraid. All these changes in your life. You're forging ahead, changing the way you behave, daring to be yourself.
So? That's a positive thing, isn't it?
Yes, it's good, but...
He couldn't spit it out. No doubt he was worried about what I might think.
But what, Sebastian? What if I don't change quickly enough for you? What if I'm not good enough for the new Camille?
So that was it. It was the last thing I was expecting him to say. I was really touched. I looked him straight in the eye and smiled with all the love that I felt.
There's no chance of that. I love you, Sebastian, more than ever. And I'm making all these changes for you too, so that you'll always want me.
Again, he said nothing, but this time brought his lips close to mine and stifled my doubts with a long, voluptuous kiss. And this time, no one and nothing interrupted him. 25. From that night on, the atmosphere at home changed completely. A warm wind blew on our love, reviving embers that seemed only too willing to burst into flame. As for my son, I had decided to adopt the principles Claude had suggested. So stop making such a big deal of parenting and taking things too much to heart. In short, to take my daily chores less seriously.
"Come down from your cross. We need the wood," Claude had told me one day with a laugh to help me understand I had to give up my role of a martyred mother on the verge of a nervous breakdown and look at things in a different way. First and foremost, I took the time to become more interested in Adrienne's world. On the sly, I got myself up to date with all the latest news on the world of soccer. I even learned by heart the names of the best players and the main rules of the game. So instead of being a dreary waste of time for me, the next match night was a real joy. The astonishment on the faces of my boys was something to behold. For once, Adrienne sought my attention as much as his father's.
"Did you see that, Mum?"
he kept shouting, slapping my back like one of his friends. And when his favorite team scored, it was my arms he jumped into to howl, "Goal!" There was no doubt I'd scored a goal or two myself. I also tried to learn about his musical world by listening to his favorite singers, Bruno Mars, Ariana Grande, Nicki Minaj, Jason Derulo, David Guetta. The first time I joined in singing one of his favorite songs, he was amazed, and I thought I saw something like admiration mingled with respect in his eyes. My new approach completely altered the tone of our relationship. At last, we were beginning to talk to each other again. Taking advantage of this, I tackled the contentious issue of his homework.
"You know, Adrien, I hate it when I get angry with you, when I have to shout at you about your homework, and then we have an argument. It makes me feel dreadful. I'd really like things to change. Wouldn't you?"
He nodded.
"Do you think you could tell me why you find it so difficult to get down to your work?"
He took his time to think this over, and I was touched that he was trying so hard to explain.
"I don't know. The problems aren't easy, and there are too many of them. And then you get so angry about it that I get angry too. I'm scared I'll mess up and you'll shout, which means I don't even want to try anymore."
This hit home, and I thought of Claude's advice to lay my tendency to criticize to rest, and instead to talk of my own feelings, to say, "I." "When I get upset," I explained to him, "it's because I'm worried for you. I think about your future, and I'm scared that you don't take your studies seriously enough. It's so important for later on that you work hard at school. What I want is for you to have the best possible life when you grow up."
"I know that, Mum. But you worry too much. You don't trust me enough."
"That's possible," I admitted with a smile. "I'm only trying to be a good enough mother."
"Whoa, you're a super mum."
"Do you really think so?"
"Of course," he reassured me, taking my hand in his with an impish smile.
My heart swelled with gratitude. I thought of the positive learning techniques Claude had taught me.
"What do you think about changing the way you do your homework?" I suggested.
"How?"
"Well, we could try to make it more fun, for example."
"That'd be cool."
"Give me 5.
We high-fived and then had a big hug.
"I love you, Mum,"
he murmured into the crook of my neck. I hugged him even tighter.
"And I love you too, sweetheart."
From then on, I started to help him with his work in a way that was less orthodox, but oh so much more fun. For example, I used the principle of grandmother's footsteps for the answers to his homework. You can take 1 step toward the table if you get it right, but go back 2 if you get it wrong. Or learning lessons through singing. It was a huge success. Not only did Adrien learn 3 times as quickly, but he also enjoyed himself. I used the same approach to help with cooking. Instead of making myself hoarse, yelling for help that never came, I thought of a trick to motivate Adrien. I convinced him to create an imaginary restaurant with him as head chef. His eagerness to join in and play the game surprised me. I hadn't expected such a positive reaction. He took the idea so seriously that he even created a completely original recipe for meatballs with 7 spices, Indian style. I diced the meat and he minced it. I cut up garlic and he made breadcrumbs. Whereas normally it was almost impossible to get him away from his screens, he seemed completely fascinated by this. The final stage of rolling the meatballs in egg and then the breadcrumbs with sesame seeds was a real celebration. I had a flashback to him 5 years earlier playing with Play-Doh in that magically absorbed way little children have. During this intense cooking session, we didn't say much but smiled and gestured in complete harmony. As a Michelin-starred chef, Adrien enjoyed giving me orders as if I were his assistant, a role I accepted happily because I was so pleased to see my strategy succeed. These changes also gave me more time and energy to undertake another hugely important task, launching my new professional project. I had made up my mind. I didn't want to carry on with my career in sales, but to go back to my first dream, to design and make children's clothes. As Claude never ceased reminding me, it was time for me to make what I did with my life coincide with who I was and what I believed. I began by making exploratory inquiries. In my heart of hearts, I didn't want to take on a franchise. I wanted to create my own brand, my own concept. I quickly had to face facts, however. The market for off-the-rack children's clothes seemed saturated, and there were very few openings. Another unavoidable conclusion: with the economic crisis, people would never spend huge sums on baby clothes that would be too small only a month later. So, what could I do? Inspiration came when I did some Google storming, something Claude had mentioned as a good way to come up with ideas. I came across a Dutch company that proposed a kind of fashion leasing. You rented a pair of jeans for a year, just like a car or an apartment, by paying a €5 monthly subscription. Clients could be sure they always had a brand name article of clothing that was trendy too, while at the same time promoting sustainable fashion, and in the end being able either to buy the article or to return it and rent something else. My brain kicked into gear. Why not use the same principle for baby clothes? Ethical garments for children from birth to 3 years old. I could give them added value by making each one unique in design and fabric. I would only need to link up with manufacturers of basic sustainable clothing, rompers, t-shirts, pants, and then customize them. Fashionable, ready-made clothes to suit every budget. I felt like I was onto something. My mind was racing, carried away by my enthusiasm. All parents love to create a look for their child. Who hasn't drooled over adorable tiny baby clothes? The only snag, the prohibitive price of items that are outgrown so quickly. But with my idea, proud parents would be able to renew the wardrobe of their little darlings by leasing rather than buying it. I did a quick calculation and confirmed that a €5 monthly subscription could work. I enthusiastically set to work on the details of my project. I began to create my first basic designs to have something to show my future partners. On Claude's advice, I approached a business incubator, a company that helped entrepreneurs develop new ideas, and prepared a thorough business plan to present to them. After that, I crossed my fingers in the hope that the company's accreditation committee would accept my proposal. Things were looking decidedly rosy. I could feel the good vibes. 2 weeks later, when I received a positive response from the startup people, I almost collapsed in gratitude, and in spite of what were, after all, reasonable doubts, Sebastian had decided to support me. Now all that remained was to announce the good news to my mother. That thought was much less enticing. To her, having a staff position was the only possible way to work. Knowing her as if I had brought her into the world, rather than the reverse, I was very apprehensive about telling her, and I was right to be. 26. When I rang the doorbell to the little apartment where I was raised, my mother greeted me with a broad smile and a big hug. I was apprehensive about what I was about to tell her. I knew that in a few moments our harmony might be dashed to pieces. "Sit down, darling. I'll be with you straight away. I just have to see how supper's doing. It's veal stew." "Mom, you didn't need to go to so much trouble. I said we could just have something simple." "It's absolutely no trouble. And I love making it." I gave in as ever. I sat down on the sofa in the small living room, legs crossed and my anxious heart keeping time with the big Art Deco clock that dominated the room, brought back from a visit to New York. My mother came to join me, delighted at the idea of a girly chat. "There we are. Now, I'm all yours." When I cleared my throat, she noticed how uneasy I was, and a shadow flitted across her face. "Are you all right, darling? You look out of sorts." "The thing is, I've got some important news for you."
"Oh my God, are you leaving Sebastian?"
"No, Mom."
"So he's leaving you?"
"Mother," I hissed, annoyed. "Why do you always have to project your anxieties onto me?" Her face grew darker still.
I'm not projecting, darling. I'm just being realistic about life. Just look at what your father did to us. But that's what happened to you, Mom.